I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you, and indeed to our speakers who are here today. The chairs will introduce them formally in a little while. We planned today more than a year ago, and I have watched with more than a passing interest at the daily reporting almost of crime and the effect that it has. So this is a very relevant and pertinent discussion for us to be taking part in. 2 years ago, Claudia Nielsen, on behalf of the Science Medical Network, and Martin Wall, who was our president before me, got together and initiated an event in which a topic of mutual interest could be aired and discussed. And on that occasion, we looked at the healing intention. I'm very pleased to say that both Claudia and Martin are here again to chair today's event. Please welcome Martin and Claudia.
Thank you, Jackie, so much. I've not got a great deal to add to what Jackie said, other than to speak of our section, the section of hypnosis and psychosomatic medicine. What really gives me such great pleasure is that we can come together with the network and share outcomes and get such a marvellous range of speakers that we've got today. We're going to be able to look at this from so many angles. And that's what networking can be about. And just to meet colleagues from different walks of life, from different professions, it always engages me. And I think, you know, I celebrate this, and I trust we can keep meeting together. We are all here to hear these speakers. You're not here to hear me or Claudia, but I'd like just to introduce Claudia, and she will sell the network to you, and then we'll get on with the conference.
Thank you, Martin. And thank you, Jackie, very much indeed. It was Jackie's initiative for us to be here today on the theme of criminal intent. I represent the Scientific and Medical Network, as Martin said. We are both members of the SMN, and we are both members also of the British Society for Clinical and Academic Hypnosis. So we are colleagues. And can I ask, how many of you are members of the network? Okay, thank you. For those who are not, the network is a membership organization exploring issues around science, spirituality, consciousness, human experience. And we organize conferences, lectures, residential conferences throughout the year. We've got leaflets out there. You may be interested to have a look and perhaps even become members. It explains what we do, and also we have local groups. So we have got groups in London, which in fact I organize. I'll say some more about that later. But we've got groups all over the country. So today we are coming together to explore criminal intent and responsibility, conscious or unconscious motivation. The question of responsibility is a very central question in psychology and psychotherapy, which is my profession. And there are schools of thought which promote the fact that we are not responsible at all for our actions, that it is all to do with early life experiences or different other sources. And there is another school of thought that says we are responsible entirely for our actions. And in no field is this particular issue more important than criminality. So today we are going to be exploring this with our speakers, Sir Roger Tolson, Professor David Cantor, Professor Graham Wagstaff, and we were going to have Professor Sean Spence today, but very sadly, he is very unwell, and our best wishes go out for him. But he couldn't come today, so very last minute, in fact, 3 days ago, Professor Chris Idzikowski agreed to step into his shoes and deliver a lecture today for us. And we are incredibly grateful for that. Thank you so much. I haven't had a huge amount of time to talk to Chris. His lecture is entitled Criminal Responsibility, Neuroscientific Nightmare, and an underlying phrase, Can People Lie in Their Sleep? Professor Chris is, he is the director of the Center for, Sleep?
Edinburgh Sleep Center,
yes. And he, at the RSM, he set up the sleep medicine section some years back, and he had a meeting on sleep consciousness and the law. I can't even read my own writing. And the law. Anyway, without more ado, I'd like you to join me in welcoming Chris Idzikowski, please.
Thank you. Actually, I'm going to just make sure there's power for the laptop throughout the whole talk. Yeah. I didn't want to tell Claudia, but when around just as she invited me, I went deaf in one ear, and so I've got deaf and tinnitus on one side, and I'm saying, yes, I'll do the talk, and then I realise what the talk's about. So part of the reason I haven't talked to her for a bit is I've been trying to get this organised. Let me just see whether everything with this works good. Okay. So, really the question I was asking last night was, why me? While I was being introduced, it actually occurred to me that there is a sort of another potential subtitle for the talk with criminal responsibility, and it's partly on the neuroscientific nightmare component, and that is somebody saying in the witness stand or standing in the dock saying, it wasn't me that done it, it was my brain. Anyway, whoops. So, do you want to talk about, yes, I said yes, sounds interesting. My background's primarily psychology, clinical pharmacology, been in the sleep area a long time. I think the reason I was asked was partly because I do legal work now, and I'm going to talk about some of that, and also the meeting that Claudia talked about, sleep consciousness and the law. I became interested in consciousness about 10, 12 years ago and have been running various meetings that deal with aspects of consciousness. Within that meeting, the questions were along the line of, what is there voluntary control? What's voluntary? Now, I'm not going to tap into what I suspect other speakers will be talking about later today, this sort of issue of what voluntary is. But there are experiments that indicate that if you're in an experimental situation where you're making what you think is a decision to do something, in fact, the brain's already made the decision for you, and you're just sort of acting, you're continuing with the action, whereas in fact the decision's already been made. So the whole issue of voluntariness is an awkward one, but I think it'll be dealt with more later on. Levels of consciousness I will talk about. How complex can behaviour be without insight is something that I'll deal with, and sleep disorders and the law will sort of be part of the nucleus of the talk. The aspect that may interest you more, I don't know for sure, is when we're looking at methods of measuring what the brain is doing, how well they actually relate to mental activity. So the question that, 10 years ago it was straightforward, where does consciousness go? Sleep ought to be a good model for trying to identify. I mean, there are all sorts of ways of defining consciousness, there are lots of philosophical issues, but the bottom line is that during the night, during sleep, most people's consciousness at some point is switched off. There's always a problem with defining what actually sleep is, and sometimes I just describe it as a supremely inattentive state. One loses attention to both internal and external stimuli. There is some connection, obviously, with dreaming. As far as the brain's concerned, part of what sleep is about is just disconnecting. If you're looking at brain systems, one of the unifying features of what sleep is about is an area of the brain called the thalamus that kind of goes into neutral. It's rather like the brain's still working a fair bit, but it's like putting the clutch in a car. A lot of the things aren't being connected and processed. With Sleep and the Law, the key issues are to do with actus reus and mens reus, and I'm sure that's going to be covered, so I'm not going to touch on that much. But the notion is you can't commit a criminal act unless it can be proven that you've actually done the act, but you also, that's the actus reus, but also mens reus is you had the criminal mind, you had the mind to actually do the act. I think that'll be covered in the next talk. And again, with a lot of the sleep areas, automatisms are the main key, and that is conducting behaviour where you don't have voluntary control of the behaviour. As far as the law is concerned, it then also splits that up into whether the lack of control is to do with a diseased mind on the one hand, so insane automatisms, versus non-insane automatisms, which are regarded as external to the mind in some way. So one of the classic descriptions is along the lines of if there's a bee in the driving in a driver's cab and you're reacting to the bee, then actually you weren't in control. It was the bee outside. It was outside of the mind. It was a reflex action. There wasn't criminal intent, and so no criminal responsibility. Criminal responsibility, this is just partly to ground me for the talk. In order to have criminal responsibility, one needs intentionality. One needs to have voluntary control over what one's doing. One needs to be able to have some insight into the fact that the act that you're committing is one where you are being a criminal. It is outside the law. You have to have sufficient self-control, so it's out of that situation where it's a reflex action, and one needs some level of consciousness to provide a lot of the insight into what one's doing. I'm going to quote a couple of both neuropsychologists and neuroscientists here, because I think they describe the situation quite well in terms of where neuroscience is. It's an extreme position. Neuroscience will never find the brain correlates of responsibility, because that's something we ascribe to humans, not brains. It's a moral value we demand of our fellows. And Gazzaniga goes on, neuroscience can add little to our understanding of responsibility, because responsibility is a human construct that exists only in the social world. Okay. And then we carry on. Brains are not responsible, acting people are. The way I'd kind of put that in this schematic is if you have some kind of... the law likes dichotomy, so you're either not criminal or criminal in terms of action. But if one's thinking about neurobiological markers, whatever they might be, and I'll be talking about those, then the idea is that perhaps there's a way of using a marker to identify where you are on that line. And maybe the marker will show that indeed you're a criminal. But I think the problem is, and Gazzaniga and the others flag it, is this whole notion of criminality might actually move depending on what the definition of what a criminal construct is. So the problem with a neurobiological marker is it tends to be a lot more fixed. It doesn't really necessarily match up to what the constructed rules are. I'm going to talk about consciousness now. Now, I work in Edinburgh, and there are various ways of measuring consciousness, but I thought I would mention the Glasgow Coma Scale, which is a recognised measure that paramedics and doctors will use on scenes or beside the bed. I'm not going to go through all of it. There's the motor responses. I think the thing that strikes me is when you're looking at best verbal response, and I don't know if any of you have actually been in Glasgow on a Saturday night, but you will find... quite often there is no verbal response. There might be incomprehensible speech, moaning, but no words. Inappropriate speech, random or exclamatory articulated speech, but no conversational exchange. Confused conversation, patient response to questions in a conversational manner, but some disorientation, confusion. And either Sunday or Monday morning, oriented patient knows who he is, where he is, why, the year, season, and the month. Okay, and there are other indices within the Glasgow Coma Scale. If one considers consciousness and levels of consciousness and essentially how awake the brain is, or how much of the brain's systems are working, We end up dividing up various areas now in terms of what one can find clinically. So clearly with something like a vegetative state, a lot of the brain is dysfunctional. There is very little in the way of consciousness, but what the brain imaging work has been showing over quite a few years now is that one can have some degree of conscious awareness. So the brain is quite active, but not that much consciousness going on. Or rather nasty state of locked-in syndrome, where the person can be fully awake, they do have sleep, their sleep cycles and things, but they're pretty much unable to operate at all. Minimally, they'll be able to move their eyes around to indicate that they are picking up something. We have sleep running sort of across this whole set of dimensions. So when one's fully awake and conscious, the brain is firing on all cylinders, and consciousness is and awareness is fully switched on. The thing about sleep is you can run down this sort of level of arousal where the brain is still operating a lot, but there isn't that much consciousness. And REM sleep is kind of placed here, but sometimes I would actually put it much further up in that the degree of external conscious awareness in rapid eye movement dreaming sleep is low, but a lot of the brain is operating, and I'll deal with that momentarily. Just a flag in terms of how sleep is controlled. In fact, they're very low-level brain systems that manage our states of sleep and wakefulness. I've got Awakenings here, the Oliver Sacks book, which goes back to the encephalitis lethargica patients that survived an outbreak just before World War I. With those patients, they either died or ended up in a mute state. But the neuropathologist, the chap who was chopping up the brains looking to see what happened to the patients that died, identified systems that maintain sleep and systems that maintain wakefulness. And in terms of the millions and millions of neurons in the brain, we're only talking about 60,000, 80,000 nerve cells that promote the state of sleep, and 60,000, 80,000 nerve cells at the beginning anyway, that promote the state of wakefulness and drive the rest of the brain. And problems with sleep can occur with interactions between the two systems. So you can have something like the wakefulness side driving on, but also the sleep side trying to cut in and creating all kinds of problems. When I started, this chap's Ian Oswald in Edinburgh decades ago now. He was a working psychiatrist who had thought he could both manage a clinical practice and do research on the side by doing night work. So he was sticking on electrodes to see what was going on in the brain. He was responsible for one of the restorative hypotheses of sleep. One of the wards that he ran was the failed suicide ward, where in those days people overdosed on barbiturates. And he put on the electrodes to see what their sleep was like and found huge amounts of what's called rapid eye movement sleep. And so he simply hypothesized that because they'd poisoned their brains with barbiturates and there was a lot of REM going on, perhaps REM was a brain restorative process. And then the other side of it was there was an Iron Man kind of competition in South Africa that found that deep sleep was associated with possibly with body restoration. But the usual thing, you put on electrodes. The thing about measuring sleep is one uses scalp electrodes to measure brain activity, then electrodes on the eyes to measure what the eyes are doing, and electrodes on the chin generate to measure muscle tone. The thing about measuring brain waves is although the temporal resolution with brain wave technology is extremely good, you're down to millisecond type levels, the spatial resolution in EEG is pretty poor. One's not entirely sure a lot of the time exactly where the signals are coming from. And the analogy one can use is that whatever the source of the brain waves is can be rather like a torch at the bottom of the skull, pointing up to the top of the skull and moving around. So the apparent source of the activity won't necessarily be below where the electrodes are. It could just be where the torch is pointing at the time. So although one gets these changes in EEG, and EEG is used hugely, one doesn't have that certainty of precisely where it's going on. Now, in early days, well, in fact, just a little historical note, rapid eye movement sleep, which really got everybody interested in sleep in the late 50s, early 60s, was only discovered that time. EEG itself was discovered or invented in the 1930s, and EEG produces lots of squiggly lines. I don't know whether you know Edinburgh now, because we've got problems with trams. Unfortunately, the chap who invented EEG ultimately committed suicide because none of his fellow colleagues believed he was actually picking up brain activity at all. They thought he was picking up the rumble from the trams going outside his institute. But in those days, they used to use packs of paper that only lasted about 50, 60 minutes. And the thing about rapid eye movement dreaming sleep is it doesn't usually kick in until about 90 minutes. So it wasn't until one centre happened to have bigger packs of paper that they identified this new stage, rapid eye movement sleep. And that's sort of how science progresses. What we would be doing is churning out a third of a mile of paper every night for each individual when we were doing recordings those days. Nowadays, it all goes onto a laptop and a DVD. This is the kind of thing one sees with EEG. So an objective measure of what's going on in the head. Here I'm just indicating deep sleep, slow wave sleep. The brain, in many ways, what we thought for a long time, because so much of the brain was uniformly generating these large, slow waves, the idea about sleep at one point was that it was rather like putting on a nightcap and the brain was just generally shut down and go into some kind of neutral mode. That was what was thought up to about 10 years ago. Another stage here, transition, which is important, is rapid eye movement, light sleep into rapid eye movement sleep. So with rapid eye movement sleep, its original name was called paradoxical sleep. It was called paradoxical because when you were looking at the brain waves, it looked as if the person was awake because the eyes were moving around in conjugate fashion as if one was looking at something. It looked as if the person was awake. Paradoxical because during that stage, muscle tone is a zero. You can't do anything during rapid eye movement dreaming sleep. And so we get to the law, of course, because one of the conditions I'll talk about is rapid eye movement behavior disorder, where that muscle atonia, where that muscle paralysis doesn't switch on and you start to act out your dreams. And one of the sad features about REM, if you don't get as far as court, is that it's male dominant. In fact, it's turned out to be a nasty disorder in the sense that it predates the development of Parkinson's anything like 2 to 20 years before. So if REM behavior disorder develops, about 85% of patients will subsequently develop Parkinson's. The sad feature is that it is sort of male dominant, and as it turns out, most males dream about football. One ends up with what can be, with couples who have got a good relationship, a sort of S&M relationship develops where the wife ties the man down for the night to avoid being kicked too much. But also there's unfortunately a lot of violent activity too. I won't dwell on this too much, but generally as far as sleep's concerned, there's roughly a 90-minute cycle of rapid eye movement sleep. The main thing about legal consequences is somnambulism, sleepwalking, occurs mainly in deep sleep, and that occurs usually roughly in the first 3 hours of sleep. Now, one thing about neuroscience, scientific methods, we generate these stages using EEG and the other electrodes. When one's looking at the effects of sleeping pills, what one finds is that the benzodiazepines and the Z compounds, patients will like to take those and they'll say that they sleep a lot better. And if you're taking subjective measures of what they're saying, they'll say they improve. But when you look at the objective measures, in fact, the improvements are very minor indeed. So a person can be telling you that they sleep an hour or two more, whereas the objective measure actually indicates maybe 15, 20 minutes improvement. So it's one of the disassociations one can get from a brain measure and what a person is perceiving. Insomniacs sort of come through the centre. One of the things I always tell the insomniacs is we're not likely to record you, or at least I won't in the first instance, because it doesn't really tell us very much. The three possible outcomes for an insomniac when they come into a sleep centre. The first one is quite often they sleep hugely well the first night. And the reason that probably happens is a lot of insomnia is conditioned to the situation that they're in. And if they're passing care, because they're worried about what's happening to them, if they're passing the problem insomnia to somebody else, you suddenly have this relief of anxiety, a new situation, and the pressure for sleep that's built up because they're not sleeping well is released, and they sleep very well and say, that's the first time it's happened for ages, so that doesn't work for them. The second outcome is they don't sleep very well, and diagnostically that doesn't get one anywhere. But the third outcome, which is important for, again, for the talk, is a condition called sleep state misperception, where although most people will misperceive how well they sleep during the night, good sleepers tend to be relatively accurate, poor sleepers less so. But in the condition sleep state misperception, which we tend to pick up on clinical trials when we're recording people, you can have gross misperception, where they're sleeping 7 hours or so, but claiming only 1 or 2 hours sleep on that night. And again, in terms of therapeutic management, it's a disaster because there's little point in telling somebody that they've slept 5, 6, 7 hours when all they're perceiving is 1 or 2 hours. More recently, and this condition is sort of only just being explored, one can have the reverse situation in chronic pain syndrome patients, where they end up perceiving that they sleep a lot more than they actually do. So they say that they're sleeping 7 or 8 hours, but actually they're only sleeping 2 or 3 hours. So one again has that disassociation between what a person perceives and what's actually happening in terms of the brain measures that we're using. Okay. With regards to the law and sleep, the where one gets an interaction is mainly amongst a set of conditions called parasomnias. So as far as sleep's concerned, there are really three sort of main blocks. You either can't sleep when you want to, or you can't stay awake when you want to, or you do things while you're asleep that you shouldn't be doing or you don't want to do. So the sleepwalking, night terrors, REM sleep behavior disorder, I've partly mentioned, confusional arousal, a couple of other conditions, delirium and dystonia. Other common causes, sleep apnea, not breathing properly during the night, can trigger off all kinds of reactions, brain syndromes, narcolepsy, and epilepsy. Now, narcolepsy is a condition that is interesting in that we have this situation where the 60 or so thousand nerve cells that promote wakefulness end up being destroyed for whatever reason. So a combination of genetic susceptibility factors, viral attack, knocks it out. But for those individuals, as they're developing this condition of not being able to stay awake when they want to, one has an in-between or an early stage where they're misperceiving what's going on in their mental world. They actually go into rapid eye movement dreaming sleep quite quickly. So if I was suffering from early sort of narcolepsy now, at the moment I know I'm reasonably grounded, that I'm perceiving things correctly, but if you all start to float off your chairs in towards the ceiling, then I know that I've started to move into a state of sleep. The problem is young narcoleptics have problems identifying that, and we went through a huge period of time where they were being misclassified with psychiatric disorders as opposed to what was actually a sleep disorder. I once had the joy of, because narcoleptics are spontaneously sleepy individuals, the joy of giving a lecture to the British Association, which consists of about 300 narcoleptics. And one of the things about narcoleptics is if you get them excited, they in fact this muscle atonia associated with REM causes them to collapse. So I gave this very careful talk for about an hour. And got a round of applause, which was good. Looked at the chairman, smiled. Somebody rushed up and said, "Yes, that's fantastic. Would you come back next year?" And I'm thinking, "Great." And the chairman's going, No. "They want you back next year so that they can see hear the rest of the talk." They were all drifting. I'm drifting myself here. Right. there are sex differences in terms of. In terms of these violent disorders during sleep, I think where it relates to criminality is the issue of empathy. There's also this sex difference between men and women that develops from childhood onwards, where part of the brain imaging work sort of tries to deal with that. I'll tap on that later. Yes, because I should talk about sleep and law and automatisms and so forth. Most of my work involves either death or body fluids. I mean, it's just I rarely have nice stories to tell. Well, I think I've potentially got one from the case I was in just recently, and it sort of flags the difficulty in what one has in a legal case. This chap was, which happens quite often with sleep drivers, he was driving in his sleep, and he managed about 0.2 of a mile. He drove out of his drive, crashed the car, and neighbour observed, this is about 1:30 in the morning, neighbour observed that he tried to reverse the car, looked around the car, and then went back home and rang the police to say that his car had been stolen. And the reason I was involved for this aspect of the case was the police then charged him with perverting the course of justice because he was lying about the car being stolen. Now this case is finished now. We dealt with the automatism reasonably well. We recorded him in the laboratory and had enough to identify that he had the potential for being a sleepwalker. He was taking the drug Zopiclone, which is one of the sleeping pills, and one of the things about the sleeping pills is it causes amnesia. In fact, when we were trying to reconcile why people on sleeping pills are saying they're sleeping so well, whereas the objective measures are indicating that they're not sleeping well, one of my sort of lines is, well, maybe they just don't remember how bad that night was with the sleeping pill. But in this case, the way the trial actually worked out was we put the automatism question to the side, whether he drove in an automatism, in a state of automatism, and dealt with the key question of was he lying to the police. And there, the jury ultimately accepted that actually he was probably amnesic to the situation. So in that 15, 20 minutes where he was trying to sort himself out, when he walked back home during that time, he actually had forgotten what had happened, saw the car wasn't in the drive, and immediately rang the police to say it was stolen. Anyway, well, I don't know how far that case will go, but ultimately he was acquitted. Okay, somnambulism is, as you can see, all good stuff. this is a more unusual case, and the problem we have in the area is one that this is where the law interacts with the clinical side, is we have lots and lots of case studies that have gone through the court systems, and of course they're not scientific studies. And quite often one is asked questions that are very hard to answer accurately because there isn't much science behind them. We've got some laboratory science where we can start to estimate what may be going on. But when one comes to practical situations, it's much more difficult. And this is, say, one of the cases where the man drove a huge distance. And for the most part, I'd be very sceptical as to whether that was actually in a state of automatism and that he was sleepwalking, whether it was a different state. The way it worked out in that particular case is no other disorder could be found, and it sort of defaulted into sleepwalking because the man was a sleepwalker. Now, nowadays, because there's much more publicity in the area, we have the difficulty that people who are sleepwalkers are beginning to claim that their crimes were caused whilst in a state of sleepwalking. And there one ends up looking for evidence that actually they set up the situation so they could use that as a defence. Okay, I'd better roll on. Basically, when you're sleepwalking, the motivation is one of the words in the title of the meeting. Most sleepwalkers really have very little idea why they're doing anything at all. Night terrors, which is similar to sleepwalking, where people are sort of screaming and possibly doing something, we'll be talking about this particular one with somebody saying that they thought a black hole was about to swallow them up, but it's usually quite vague images. Okay, I'm going to... I have to finish at 10:30, so what I'm going to do is zoom past sleep. Well, as I pause on that one, remember to wear pyjamas and nightdresses if you're a sleepwalker. Sometimes it's accepted as an excuse, other times it's not. Okay. Oops, sorry. Peter Fenwick is the key chap in this area, and he always finishes his talk by saying, if it's a forensic case, consider that actually the person's lying. Okay. REM behavior disorder, a different situation. I was talking about kicking, but basically quite often what's going on with REM behavior disorder, where you get this dissociation between appreciating what's real and what's in your mental world, is a classic Edinburgh case in the 19th century where a chap was dreaming that his child was being about to be attacked by a lion or some predator, and picked up the child to throw it to safety, but in reality picked up the child, threw it against the wall and killed it. And there the jury accepted, and the judge accepted, that he didn't do it voluntarily. He had mismatched what was going on in his head versus what reality was. Actually, I will go on a quicker side, a rather stranger case, which was somnambulism, deep sleep somnambulism, which was a detective, a French detective, who killed somebody and then ended up on the case and worked out that it was he who had actually killed. So his sentence, the Edinburgh judge decided the best thing to do was that the man wouldn't sleep with anybody ever again in his life. With the French detective, the French court decided that he could still operate as a detective as long as he went to prison to sleep for the night. Okay. And I just want to do a little bit of data. When we're trying to decide what's happening in a sleep-related case, we have these apparent absolutes that people don't recall anything that's going on, external stimuli don't go in. In fact, it turns out not to be the case if you're looking at somnambulistic patients. For the most part, although they don't remember a lot of the time, there is quite a lot of memory behaviours. And similarly, their environment can go in. There can be some thinking going on. We're talking about just relatively low levels. So the general point is, when one's got clinical data and one's trying to generalise to specific cases, a lot of the time we're generalising, there are actually quite a lot of exceptions. So in terms of the law, we have this problem of some cases an expert will be going on an absolute statement, whereas the reality is much more mixed than that. Okay. I'm going to pass through that and move to, I'm not going to deal hugely why I've got a dancer involved in this talk, but because I want to talk about functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is sort of the new way of looking at what the brain's doing, and I have an interest in sleep and memory, and it turns out that sleep has an impact on movement memory, but this was the first slide I came across that had some scans of a brain and bits that are active. The thing about dancers is when you compare them to normal individuals, that's not right, they're not abnormal, to non-dancers, you find that areas of the brain, as they're going through dance movements, light up differently. Other areas are involved. Perhaps there are notions of musicality, rhythmicity, whatever. But the thing about magnetic resonance imaging, which I'll be talking about, is basically it means putting somebody into a big, massive magnets that realign how the atoms are lined up in the brain and identifying which parts of brain are active or not during whatever activity you want the person to do. Now, I thought I'd Google. I was trying to find some slide to show you about functional magnetic resonance imaging. So this was last night, and Sean Spence was going to be talking about lying in part. So I Googled fMRI how to, and of course the second thing that pops out is how to beat an fMRI lie detector. Which turned out to be quite interesting, actually. First, I read about how to fool a polygraph, how to fool EEGs, and the classic way of using lie detectors, where what, in fact, this chap is saying, and this chap is a Princeton prof who does computational mathematics on magnetic resonance imaging data, but his tip for how to deal with lie detectors is to have a thumbtack a drawing pin in your shoe, so that when you're being asked questions which you're answering truthfully, you're sort of pressing on the drawing pin. Then also you don't press on the drawing pin when you're lying. And I suppose I better not tell you how to do it with fMRI, just to keep you straight. bits of brain that are important: prefrontal cortex, which I'll be bouncing along, and anterior cingulate cortex. Going to go back to sleep first. The first thing about sleep I said to you earlier is that we thought with EEG measures that it was rather like putting a nightcap over somebody's head. In fact, what we now know is that the brain is hugely active during sleep. It's slightly less active in deep sleep, but as far as comparisons with wakefulness are concerned, it's almost as active. And when you're in rapid eye movement dreaming sleep, sometimes it's more active than the waking state. So it's not that the brain shuts down, but the EEG measures would kind of have pointed to that. So sort of big difference with that. If one's looking at brain structure and dream features, the kind of thing that one can do is consider, firstly, what's going on in the main. So I'm thinking about the frontal areas of the brain. There's less activation in the prefrontal cortex, which means things like logical reasoning, working memory, and executive functions aren't working as well when you're in that state. Perceptual features, if information were going, you could perceive things, you end up looking at your internal world. So this is looking at fMRI brain imaging and correlating it with mental experience and making some generalizations about which bits of brain are active for those elements of one's mental world. So say with lesions in these areas, these would be the individuals who don't perceive their dreams. Emotional features, because the amygdala further down, orbitofrontal cortex we'll mention, and anterior cingulate cortex are switched on, one ends up with those areas operating. Memory content, you get some activations, you're coming back to memory, and I'll hit that in a second. Some work by McKay, 2005, who's done most work with brain imaging and sleep. Different areas are active in different stages. I then identify what those are. The main thing is, as far as REM sleep is concerned, areas like the orbitofrontal cortex are reduced in activity. And if you sort of go back to that and think about, well, what happens when those areas are wound down? With executive functions, external stimuli, with the executive, you're able to put together and construct what your almost field of consciousness is. Within sleep, the dorsal premotor cortex that helps you sort out what your movements are is still switched on, but the caudal prefrontal and ventral prefrontal areas are switched off, which means any context or any episodic information about your mental world isn't operating. So one of the reasons dreams start to move into being unusual compared to reality is because those areas of brain are switched off. Perceptual control is maintained, the visual processing areas are switched on, which means that you perceive things, but you can't coordinate all the information because these other areas are switched off. Okay. One thing that was striking, because they went back having looked at what areas of brain were switched off, was that, in fact, dream reports of waking life during the night, although they feature in a kind of Freudian way, you get elements of waking coming through. In fact, complete episodes running through what happened during the day only number less than 2% of dream reports. And so there it actually works the right way around, a sort of hypothesis in terms of knowing what was happening in terms of the brain led one forwards in terms of identifying precisely what was going on in the mental world. In these areas, as far as attention is concerned, a lot of our attention is driven by identifying what we're actually trying to track. But there's another element of the attentional system which is driven by identifying salient or new information. And that doesn't operate during dreaming, which means attention isn't brought in with new features that are occurring in the mental world, and it could be one of the explanations why during rapid eye movement sleep material is incorporated from the external world without waking you up. So what's happening is if you call somebody's name, that won't necessarily wake them up in rapid eye movement sleep. What will happen is that feature will get incorporated into the dream. The area of brain that would actually wake up other parts of the brain to look at what's going on. I have got an anecdote on that, but I'll leave that to later. The frontal parietal areas that deal with theory of the mind, and there what I'm thinking about is along those lines where one has some idea of what somebody else is thinking. This is where the criminality aspect sort of starts to creep back in again. If you're looking at developmental psychology, children within about 2 years or so of age, when they're looking at a mirror, start to identify that the person in the mirror is them. But you need a few more years before they identify that the person in the mirror is the thinking person. And that's what I'm thinking about with theory of mind. This is partially operative during dreaming, where but one gets this failure, where one can both be in the dream and watching oneself within the dream. And the way that's explained is by the area of brain that manages to distinguish those two features is less active. In emotionality, the amygdala is very switched on, so the emotional content in dreams is there. Now, that was Mackay 2005. I would say he'd be the key person in this area. I didn't have enough time to get this paper. In fact, the institution or any institution that I'm linked with no longer subscribes to the International Review of Neurobiology, so I don't know quite what he said, but I see from the abstract what he says. So neuroimaging of dreaming, state of the art and limitations. So during the last two decades, yes, functional neuroimaging, we've learned lots and lots and lots. This review examines the difficulties associated with the characterization, and he finishes in Greek, which fortunately he does actually, or at least the editors translate. It comes from Socrates, and he ends up saying, "The only thing I know is that I know nothing." Okay, I am now wrapping up. So, Sean Spence was going to talk. Well, two things. Part of his area is deals with deception and using functional magnetic resonance imaging to identify what areas of brain are involved. I mentioned the orbitofrontal cortex in the sleep context at one point, but one of the things he noted in earlier work is that the orbitofrontal cortex is hugely developed in pathological liars, and the question that he was raising was, in fact, raised because although one has that neurobiological marker, it's not clear whether that part of the cortex is well developed because they are lying or because it was well developed in the first place that gave them the ability to lie. So a marker in itself doesn't necessarily tell you how it arose or indeed how it's being used. His model of 2004 was quite certainly sophisticated. It used the cognitive thinking of the time plus the imaging. I think he's actually ended up moving away from that. And looking at the abstract of the talk that he would have given, kind of tells one that. So the dimension he started to think about or is now exploring is he took it from a theological line to start off with, that there was a moral universe and the real world, and the two are quite separated. And the thing about brain imaging is it seems to be impinging into the moral and spiritual world because we seem to be getting at more and more of what the brain is doing and displacing that with other ideas. But I think ultimately he probably ends up with what we still can't quite identify, what's going on in somebody's mental world. And I separate spiritual, just thinking about mental world, by using measures on what brains are doing. Now, the funny thing was, I was doing another talk, in fact, a couple of months ago, talking a bit about brain imaging. And when I was rooting through these slides, what did I find? Well, it was the Rorschach ink blot test. Okay. I'm now on the last slide. I think the worrying thing is, again, when I was sort of looking to see how brain measuring techniques, whatever they are, either EEG or magnetic resonance imaging, how they're already being used. So, well, I was surprised to see that EEG is still being used. EEG went through a vogue of being regarded as a great measure of what brain activity is. But in India, somebody has been convicted of murder on the basis of EEG work. And the hypothesis, and I'd say it's just a hypothesis, or what they're promoting in with this system is this notion that you can identify whether somebody has been in a particular place. So if you've murdered somebody, the notion is that you can use this test to identify that the person has actually been in that location. There are all kinds of problems with it, but it doesn't actually mean that the person voluntarily did what they did. All it's doing is identifying that they can connect with the situation. One doesn't know whether there's coercion, in fact, whether there's accident or anything. But with this particular case, it came out as a full-blown conviction. I don't know what's happened to the defendant or the convicted person. And then in the US, a similar kind of thing going on now, where, in fact, prosecution for this chap who murdered this girl, they had some measure of psychopathy where, I think it says it there, something like 38 out of 40 of the measures they would use from brain imaging meant that this person was a psychopath, and that was used as part of the process. In fact, the jury was swayed by that. On the one hand, it convicted and then it was going for life imprisonment and then switched their sentence to execution when it was pointed out that this chap was unlikely ever to be rehabilitated, which I think in many ways is gross because we're still at the beginning of trying to understand what our measures are actually showing us. So I finish with that. Neurobiological markers can tell us a lot about, help us understand how our mental world is constructed, can help us understand how we're operating. When it comes to the legal world or the criminal world, at the end of the day, we have sets of rules which we have to apply to. So clearly, there are times where people may not understand the law, and that may be because of the condition that they're in. But as far as the neurobiology is concerned, although one could set up and identify whether somebody is in that state or not, the problem and say definitively that, the thing is the actual definition itself might change, and the neurobiological marker is left behind. And that's it, I think.
So who would like to ask the first question?
Can you tell me why lavender puts you to sleep, please? Helps you to go to sleep, I understand. Is that correct?
I'm quite fairly sceptical as far as lavender is concerned. It's the association. The thing about lavender is it's got a great history of being associated with sleep. But I ended up thinking it could well have been used initially to hide the smell from chamber pots. So one it's the same when you go into a cemetery with lots of lavender. The actual scientific evidence is negligible for the most part. The thing is, though, as far as aromas are concerned, particularly when one goes into a situation of thinking it's going to work, the association does actually develop. So I don't think there's any intrinsic, in fact, neurochemical reason. It's more of an association, and it may have arisen originally because it was a good way of helping out in the bedroom.
Thank you for this very informative talk. But I have a basic question. Why do we need sleep?
Well, the short answer is we don't know. There are two main theories, classes of theory. I mean, Oswald dealt with the restorative hypothesis, and what happened with that was that sleep's a restorative process. that theory ultimately waned, although it's sort of come back into vogue now. The other main class of theory is that it's adaptive for us to sleep. So when one's looking at predator-prey relationships, quite often preyed upon species are either silent or resting when the predators are out. I'd say something along the lines of because we're not adapted to work in the dark, then it's better to throw us into a state where we're less likely to wander around and walk off the cliff. So it's part of the process there. And that kind of underlines what we think about sleep. There are probably various reasons why one ends up in that state. There's enforced rest is a component. But sleep is entirely modifiable. In fact, I'd say that for humans, our biology probably dictates having about 5 or 6 hours during the night and a couple of hours during the day, the siesta. But in the last, well, in fact, with industrialization, the sleep has been moved in. If one looks at anthropological data across in sleep, one does find hardly anywhere nowadays, but say the first 24/7 societies were actually shepherding type societies where people were around a lot of the time to look after the flock and so on, similarly with ports and things. I'll throw a slightly different idea at you as well. So sleep and memory are related, various aspects of memory. But it never made sense to me. I did that kind of work a long time back. There's always this question of, well, why would one have to wait 15, 16 hours to have an important process like consolidating memories? And it could be that with sleep, what one does is one reveals a state that is already present in the brain. So I mentioned in the hypnogram showing the sleep stages that rapid eye movement sleep started in the first 90 minutes. And there's actually a cyclicity. So roughly every 90 minutes, one goes into rapid eye movement sleep. But if one looks at people who are awake during the day, asks what's going on in their heads, some mental thought tapping experiments, you find that daydreaming occurs roughly on a 90-minute cycle. Ad lib, hand to mouth behavior runs on a 90-minute cycle. Some brain waves run on a 90-minute cycle. So possibly what's happening is that reorganization of memory that takes place is actually happening the whole time. But with sleep, where you're disconnected from new information, there's an opportunity for it being done better. But the fundamental that you're asking, we don't know. We know a lot about what happens when you deprive people, but we still don't really know what it's about.
Do you recall a case of 7 or 8 years ago when a car fell off a bridge or connecting road onto a motorway, causing a fatal collision? The driver of the car which fell told the police he hadn't slept for whatever reason for some 24 hours, consequently was charged, convicted, and I think sentenced to imprison.
That's right.
What would the significant investigations have been there? Do you recall that?
It's the Selby railway crash, isn't it? It's the one that you're thinking about. There was very little done in the way of investigation, in fact. I think what happened with that particular case, and the experts involved just took the view that he was essentially negligent, that he should have allowed time for his sleep. I don't think there was any suggestion that a sleep disorder was in play with him. It was just the fact that he spent, and the evidence was there that he spent the time awake on the phone and texting and so on. I did have a case. These things vary. This is one where a lorry driver was on the motorway, well-known trouble spot where there'd be traffic waiting to get off the motorway, and he was described by other lorry drivers as driving as if he were a robot. He was just there like that. It was a typical sleep-related accident in that there was no avoidance. One lady was killed. The lorry hit the tailback. The lorry drivers, in fact, all realized there was potentially going to be an accident, and they all moved out of the way, expecting him to swerve in the last moment, and he didn't. Now, he suffered from obstructive sleep apnea. He was an obese man, and he suffered from it. So obstructive sleep apnea is when you can't breathe properly during the night. It was usually associated with with being overweight. But he'd suffered from it for many years, and certainly the proposition was that he ceased to identify how sleepy he was. Now, he hadn't done anything wrong the night before, normal night's sleep, and in actual fact, he'd stopped off at the motorway station to get cigarettes and sweets, got onto the motorway, this was about 7:30 in the morning, rang his wife, her wake-up call, and about 2 minutes later smashed into the back of this, and in fact it was accepted there that it was a non-insane automatism is the way it worked out. The automatism was that he kept his foot on the accelerator.
Where does lucid dreaming fit in this thing of consciousness and sleep?
Yeah, it's good fun. So first you have to go and see Inception. Inception's a decent film to how would I describe that? So lucid dreaming is where one is actively involved in one's dreams, one is aware. So those people who think they can't dream, the way to pick up your dreaming is turn on the alarm clock 15, 20 minutes earlier than usual. Have it in your head that you want to pick up what's in your head when the alarm goes off. So not Big Ben, just a little chime or something. And because the end of the night usually finishes with rapid eye movement sleep, you should start to detect the fact that you're in your dream world. With lucid dreaming, you start to actively control what's going on in your dreams. So I have an interest in that through post-traumatic stress disorder, where people have recurrent nightmares. One of the things that you can do with them is, on the one hand, during the day, you can deal with how they manage what's going on in their nightmare, in their dream world, but you can also try to teach them to lucid dream, where they manipulate what's going on in their dream and change the outcome to something that's less traumatic or less anxiety-inducing or stressful during the day. It's difficult to do. That one of the techniques to become a lucid dreamer is you go to bed thinking, I'm going to try to recognize the fact that I'm in a dream. I have got the slides, but there is no time to show you. One of the demonstrations I have is how poor we are in identifying anything. It's almost like witness testimony, where the demonstration slides are. The thing about a lucid dreamer, the hypothesis for the experiment by a chap called Mark Blagrove was, are lucid dreamers better in identifying what's going on in the mental world, realizing that it's fantasy or that it's real? And he was sort of using these slides where things were changing and nobody was noticing. The hypothesis, the study failed, but it was kind of that idea, maybe lucid dreamers are better. To become a lucid dreamer, you have to identify that you're dreaming. And a chap called Stephen LeBurge teaches that what you should be doing, or you can do as training, is try to spin yourself like a top. I can't do it today. Spin yourself like a top within the dream. And there are two outcomes. One is you just wake up. But the other is, if you're still in your dream, you've just started to control it. And from that point on, you do try to do things like fly or do something else with it. There are no correlations, incidentally, with how one feels during the day and how much one has dreamt. Some people will turn up and say, I dream hugely and I'm immensely tired. Others will talk about having a wonderful dream world and wake up the next morning feeling great as well. So there's no problem in you trying to do it. It doesn't impact on how you feel during the day. The thing about lucid dreaming is the brain tends to, certainly as far as we know in sleep, is and wakefulness, is to sort of move into a state rather than being in one state, move straight into another. And lucid dreaming is an in-between state where you're trying to drive the wakefulness side whilst you're still in rapid eye movement sleep and trying to engage that dream. So it's a very unstable state, so it's very hard to achieve. But it is that. One's in rapid eye movement sleep dreaming, but the wakefulness side is switched off on enough to start impacting on the control mechanisms for movement, but that's interpreted as a change from within the dream.
Thank you very much, Chris. And